This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Padma Lakshmi, is the host and an executive producer of the cooking competition show Top Chef. Now she's the creator and host of a new show streaming on Hulu called Taste the Nation, in which she travels to cities around the U.S., learning how foods from different cultures, including foods brought here by immigrants, contributed to what we think of as American food. Lakshmi goes to Milwaukee to explore German bratwurst and the origins of the hot dog. She learns the West African cooking traditions of the Gullah Geechee in Charleston, South Carolina, and talks with her mother about finding Indian ingredients and produce in the 1970s when she was raising Lakshmi in Queens, New York. Lakshmi's mother came from India to live in the U.S. to escape a difficult marriage. Lakshmi stayed behind with her grandparents in India until she was 4, when her mother was able to send for her. Lakshmi began her career as a model and actress. She's also a cookbook author and wrote a memoir called Love, Loss, and What We Ate. In a 2018 New York Times op-ed during the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, she wrote about how she was raped at age 16 and explained why, like Christine Blasey Ford, she never reported it to the police. Lakshmi is an ACLU ambassador for women's rights and immigration and a UN Goodwill ambassador. Let's start with a clip from the first episode of Taste the Nation, in which Padma Lakshmi travels to the Mexican-American border cities of El Paso and Juarez.
You can't visit this area without acknowledging what's going on in Washington right now.
President Trump promised there will be 400 miles of the border wall in the next 2 years.
Protesters in cities across the U.S. demanded that the Trump administration end its zero-tolerance policy at the border.
This policy has led to many migrant refugee families being put in cages as they await asylum protection. The border has become the center of a polarizing national argument about immigration policy. But on the ground, the situation is a whole lot more complicated. Inside this tiny kitchen, all of that seems a world away. This is H&H Car Wash and Coffee Shop, recipient of a James Beard Classics Award, and hands down, the most frequently suggested place for an authentic El Paso meal. Here, immigration isn't a controversial topic. In fact, many of the employees commute from Juarez daily. But no matter which side of the border they wake up on, the women that work here are masters at their craft and the backbone of this business. Today's specialty, chiles rellenos.
Padma Lakshmi, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on your new series.
Thank you.
Let's pick up where the clip left off. How do you explain that how, at the same time, Mexican food has become so popular in the U.S., there's like a taco or burrito place just about on every block nowadays. And at the same time, Mexicans have been vilified by Trump, and he's succeeded in terrifying some people about Mexican Americans coming across the border. Do you have any insight into that contradiction?
You know, in that episode, I interview the owner of that car wash and Mexican diner, and he is a Trump supporter. And there is a big disconnect between people's political views or, you know, their traditional voting ways and what they do or how they conduct themselves in their daily lives with their neighbors. And what I'm trying to do with Taste the Nation is say that those two things, policy on immigration and people's daily lives in America, are one and the same. And, you know, it's a really big problem. One of the inspirations for the show was, I remember 2 or 3 years ago when all this stuff was happening and, you know, Ted Cruz voted, you know, a lot of the time in the way you would expect Ted Cruz to vote. And yet he was seen quite often at this Mexican restaurant and he got heckled and had to leave. And I thought, you shouldn't really be able to eat Mexican food if you're not also willing to welcome Mexicans into the country. And this is the problem. You know, it's always like, well, no, we don't like Mexicans, but we don't mean Jose. We just mean all the other Mexicans. And so people compartmentalize their politics away from their daily interactions. And this is wrong because it affects people all around us.
So, you know, you mentioned the restaurant in El Paso, H&H Car Wash and Coffee Shop. And this is a shop that started years ago as a sandwich shop for the people while their car was being washed. And the owner of that shop, his son, who is middle-aged, runs it now, and you interviewed him. His last name is Haddad. He's Syrian. He's not Mexican. He's the person who you mentioned who likes Trump, plans to vote for Trump, but at the same time has this incredible Mexican restaurant that he owns.
Yes, it's kind of crazy. I mean, you know, his father, by the way, snuck in to the country from Mexico, this Syrian man. And a lot of people have said, well, why didn't you take him to task for that, you know, disconnect? And, you know, he is more than middle-aged. He's been sitting in that rocking chair for 63 years. And I just knew that if I did challenge him, even though every bone in my body wanted to, obviously, I would have gotten less information from him. I really wanted to show the complexity and contradictions of this very big issue in our country as it is, without trying to, you know, sort of meddle in it.
Let's talk about the beginning of your professional life. You started modeling in Europe. I think this started, if I understand correctly, when you were an exchange student in Madrid. You were spotted by somebody who thought you'd make a great model, and that's how your career started. When you started modeling, I don't think there were many or maybe even any people of Indian descent modeling in European or American magazines. Were you considered like an outsider because of that?
I mean, I think that was part of my appeal. You know, I really didn't start to feel attractive until I went to Europe. I knew, you know, I had a pretty face or whatever all growing up, but I didn't feel like I was beautiful or that kind of beautiful until I went to Spain and until this person sort of discovered me, you know, for lack of a better word, and told me that I could model. And that happened a couple of times in my career. You know, it also happened with Helmut Newton, because I have a big scar on my arm, which is 7 inches long, from a car accident I had at 14. And so, you know, I started modeling before the days of retouching. So I got really good at covering it with makeup, but still, it didn't dawn on me that I could actually make a living from my looks. So the fact that it happened at all was a shock to me. But I do think that, you know, there weren't any Indian models at all. Maybe there was one here or there. But, you know, I was always the only Indian girl in any casting I went to. And I do think that, you know, a lot of the attention I got was because there were no other Indian models. I mean, since then, there are many Indian models. But I think just being the first gave me a little bit of a cachet.
You know, you mentioned Helmut Newton, and you know, he was famous for his, what can I say, very like sexualized poses, often very S&M. He wanted you to show your scar, I think, as opposed to covering it up. What's one of the more unusual poses that he wanted you to take, or unusual clothing or lack of clothing that he wanted to shoot you in?
It's really interesting because when I got the job with Helmut, you know, everyone in the agency in Italy was so happy. It was like, oh my God, you got booked with Helmut. And as the days wore on and the shoot was going to happen, I started getting nervous because it was supposed to be a nude shoot. And I just didn't feel comfortable. And so I canceled on Helmut Newton 3 days before the shoot. And I went from being the most popular girl in the agency to the least likable person in the agency because of that, you know, squandering my only chance. But I just didn't feel good about it. And then he called back, you know, thankfully, and he said, well, okay, she doesn't have to be totally nude. What if she's just partially nude and, you know, just she can keep her knickers on? And I was like, okay. And so he had me leaning back on this beautiful vanity at the Grand Hotel in Monte Carlo. I was stockinged and I had a teacup or a coffee cup, I suppose, on my knee, and you just saw my, you know, half, the bottom half of my face and my cleavage. And then he, and then I started feeling comfortable with him. He talked a lot about his wife, June, who's also a photographer, who I also shot with after that. And he just, he has the air of a very kindly grandfather or uncle. You know, you don't, it's funny, the atmosphere in the studio or room when you're shooting with him was not sexual at all. But he really did like you to arch your body and elongate it. And the pose that he really wanted was me sticking my arm out so that the keloid in my scar, you know, it's a keloid scar, so the texture of the skin is a little more shiny. And he wanted that to catch the light. And you couldn't even see my face in it, which frankly was a relief in some ways because, you know, I also have these very conservative relatives all in India. And thank God this was before the internet because, you know, you could do things and get away with them in Europe and your family would be none the wiser.
Did you think it was odd that he actually wanted your scar to be accentuated in the photograph?
At first, I found it curious. The scar that I always tried to hide, the scar that always made me feel self-conscious all through my adolescence, was what this famous fashion photographer thought was really cool and beautiful. And it really changed my opinion of my own body. It was a real lesson in self-esteem. And it was sort of the start of a journey of self-acceptance for me. You know, it's really funny because when you're a brown person and you live in a white world and you see nothing but white images on billboards, on the covers and inside magazines, on TV, you know, you kind of internalize a subconscious self-loathing about your skin color. And of course, in Indian culture, there's a ton of colorism. You know, I remember my grandmother always admonishing me to take an umbrella outside so that I wouldn't get too much sun. We kids were, especially the girls, were discouraged from going out into the sun to play from the hours of 11:30 to 4:30. On the one hand, I think it saved me because I don't have a lot of sun damage, you know, for my age. But on the other hand, you know, those things that get told to you as you're a young girl and a teenager, they stick with you all your life. And now, you know, at almost 50 years of age, I feel so much better about my body and I feel better about my physical self than I ever have.
So, you know, I had mentioned that you were in a car accident when you were 14. What happened in the accident?
We were driving on a Sunday and we were on the highway and we were rear-ended and we fell down an embankment. And we were trapped in the car. We were cut out of the car by something called the jaws of life, you know, which are big, huge metal cutters. And my parents were airlifted to one hospital, and I was taken by ambulance to another. I fractured my hip, and I broke my right upper arm or humerus bone. I also broke my hand because at some point my hand went through the windshield. My mother broke 5 ribs and her sternum, and her arm as well. And my stepfather broke his leg in 4 places and his hip in 2.
That sounds so horrible.
It was horrible. And, you know, it happened exactly 2 days after I got out of the hospital with Stevens-Johnson syndrome. And the only reason my mother took me out is because she's a religious Hindu woman and she promised that she would do penance by performing a ceremony at the Hindu temple, which is 50 miles from where we lived. And on the way back from the temple, we had this car accident. It was horrible.
Did that make her lose faith?
No, but it made me lose faith. You know, my mother's amazing. She, all her life, got up at 5:30 in the morning and prayed and lit incense and read from the Ramayana. And then she cooked some of our dinner and then got ready for her shift at the hospital and then came home after a full shift and cooked and all that stuff that women do when we have to.
But you lost your faith.
Yeah. I mean, Is that a cat I'm hearing?
That's my cat Rowdy in the background. I think he's hungry.
Okay. So I did lose faith. I mean, I think I always vaguely believed in God, and I went to the temple when my mother took me, but I've always been a very secular person. But, you know, I actually did a Moth story about this, about the car accident and losing my faith. I didn't know what to make of it. I couldn't understand a God that would make me so sick and then allow me to get out of the hospital only to go right back in such a traumatic and violent way. It was a very, very, very bad car accident. I mean, if you saw the pictures of the car afterward, your stomach would turn. You would think no one could get out of that car accident alive. And yet, here we are.
So let's talk more about your early background. Your mother came to the U.S. to escape a difficult marriage. You were two. She left you behind with your grandparents until she could really get settled here and be confident that she could take care of you and support you. By the time she brought you over, you were four. Do you remember being 2 years old when she went to America? Because I'm not sure I remember anything when I was two. I always think my memory started somewhere around when I was three, but I don't really know.
I don't remember the day she left, but I remember sitting at the gate of the compound where my grandparents' house was. You know, they lived in a building, in an apartment building, and it had a sort of, you know, big gate. And I remember sitting there, and I remember my grandmother having to keep coming and bring me inside and saying, "It's getting late. What are you doing just sitting here by yourself?" And I remember waiting for my mom to come home from the office in Amrica, you know, that she was going to this place to work in Amrica, that's how I pronounced America, and that she would be home like everybody else eventually from work. I don't think I understood that America was a different country that was far away. And so I do remember just that gate. I remember the way that the cement step felt and sitting there. Because there was this bush with berries, and I remember picking those berries a lot.
When she did bring you to the U.S., did you recognize her? Did you feel like you knew who she was, or did you have to get to know who she was?
I was very excited to be joined with my mother. I came as an unaccompanied minor. You know, those days you could do that. And I got to America, and I remember her standing there with a friend, with a male friend. I don't remember at all now what he looked like, but I remember she had a knitted blanket, sort of a crocheted blanket, slung over her arm. And I remember walking to her. And that is my first memory of being reunited with my mother. But I think I instantly remembered her or was willing to take for granted that I was close to her. I don't think there was any emotional reentry.
So when you joined your mother in New York, was she living alone? Had she remarried or anything? What was her family life like?
She was living alone. She had a small apartment on the Upper East Side of New York City. And she showed me around the apartment. She showed me how to use bathroom tissue because in India we use water. So that was a change. The doorbell kept ringing because I arrived on Halloween night. And I saw this big platter of candy that I assumed was in celebration of me coming home. And she explained, you know, the concept of Halloween. And I thought, gosh, what a wonderful country. You know, you just dress up and they give you candy. Anybody, even strangers.
Padma Lakshmi, thank you very much for talking with us. And I hope you and your daughter stay well.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking with you, Terry.
Padma Lakshmi is the creator and host of the new Hulu food series, Taste the Nation. She also hosts Top Chef. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Bob Dylan's new album called Rough and Rowdy Ways. It includes the longest song Dylan has ever released, the almost 17-minute track Murder Most Foul, which became Dylan's first number one hit single when it came out in March. The new studio album is Dylan's first collection of original material in 8 years. Here's Ken.
Today and tomorrow, and yesterday too, The flowers are dying like all things do. Follow me close, I'm going to Berlin, Ali. I'll lose my mind if you don't come with me. I fuss with my hair and I fight blood feuds. I contain multitudes. Got a telltale heart.
When Bob Dylan commences his new album singing, I Contain Multitudes, the most important thing to realize in this invocation of Walt Whitman is that Dylan is also saying, you do too. He's insisting that we each contain multitudes, that we shouldn't limit ourselves to one identity, one ideology, one set of facts about our lives. Dylan isn't looking within himself here. He's looking outward, and not at an audience. He's looking at you.
'Twas a dark day in Dallas, November 63, the day that will live on in infamy. President Kennedy was a riding high. Good day to be living and a good day to die. Being led to the slaughter like a sacrificial lamb. He said, wait a minute, boys, you know who I am. Of course we do, we know who you are. Then they blew off his head while he was still in the car. Shot down like a dog in broad daylight. Was a matter of timing, and the timing was right. You got unpaid debts, we've come to collect. We're gonna kill you with hatred without any respect.
The first time I heard the epic length song Murder Most Foul, I scoffed at its puns and cheap rhymes. I'm just a patsy like Patsy Cline? Really, Bob? But I waited a day and I played it again, and then again and again, because the song took hold of me. Just under 17 minutes, with Dylan speaking his couplets over rippling piano and violin, it sweeps you up in a swirl of historic events. Let's re-enter the song in the middle of the second verse.
When you're down on New Bellum, put your money in your shoe. Don't ask what your country can do for you. Cash on the bellhead, money to burn. Dealey Plaza, make a left-hand turn. I'm going down to the crossroads, gonna flying a ride. The place where faith, hope, and charity died. Shoot 'em while he runs, boy. Shoot 'em while you can. See if you can shoot the invisible man. Goodbye, Charlie. Goodbye, Uncle Sam. Frankly, Miss Scarlet, I don't give a damn. What is the truth? Where did it go? Ask Oswald and Ruby Leonard, I know. Shut your mouth, say it, oh, asshole, now. Business is business, and it's a murder most foul.
Rough and Rowdy Ways, the title a nod to a Jimmy Rogers song, is an album that breathes, that expands and contracts as you listen to it. The good songs inflate with interest, the mediocre songs start to shrink and slink away. One example of the mediocre is the maudlin Black Rider. It contains one funny dumb penis joke, and that's about it. The jokes and the melody are much sharper on the Dr. Frankenstein riff he develops on My Own Version of You.
All through the summers into January, I've been visiting morgues and monasteries, looking for the necessary body parts, limbs and livers and brains and hearts. I'll bring someone to life is what I want to do. I want to create my own version of you.
There's a striking amount of upbeat rhythm and blues on this album. Dylan bursts with a braggart's pride on the song False Prophet.
Well, I'm the enemy of treason, an enemy of strife. I'm that enemy of the unlived, meaningless life. I ain't no false prophet, I just know what I know. I go where only the lonely can go. I'm first among equals, second to none. The last of the best, you can bury the rest. Bury them naked with that silver and gold. Put them 6 feet under and I pray for their soul.
Just as you're coming to terms with the line, I'm the enemy of the unlived, meaningless life, Dylan makes you laugh out loud with a boast worthy of Muhammad Ali. I'm first among equals, second to none, the last of the best, you can bury the rest. And the lovely waltz time ballad called I've Made Up My Mind to Give Myself to You may have little to say beyond restating the title phrase in various ways, but that doesn't make it any less lovely.
I'm sitting on my terrace, lost in the stars, listening to the sounds of the sad guitars. Been thinking it all over, and I thought it all through. I've made up my mind to give myself to you.
Dylan recently gave a rare interview to the New York Times with the historian Douglas Brinkley, the chief value of which is to confirm that Dylan is very much absorbed in current events, which is useful to know in listening to the music here. Because no matter when it was actually recorded, this album demonstrates how an artist can engage with their time without trying to score points for virtuousness. Oh yeah, and you know what else can't come across in a print interview? His band really rocks.
Rock critic Ken Tucker reviewed Bob Dylan's new album, Rough and Rowdy Ways. Coming up, we hear from Patrick Stewart. This year, he returned to the role he's most famous for, Jean-Luc Picard, in the series Star Trek Picard. He played Picard in several Star Trek films and 7 seasons of The Next Generation. Before that, he was a member of the Royal Shakespeare Company. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Give me that old-time religion. It's just what I need.
Fans of Star Trek and Patrick Stewart were delighted to see the actor return this year to his most famous role, Captain Jean-Luc Picard, in the new series Star Trek Picard on CBS All Access. It's just been renewed for a 2nd season. He made his first appearance as Picard in 1987 and has since starred in 7 seasons of The Next Generation and several Star Trek films. It's hard to imagine now, but Patrick Stewart was kind of a long shot to play the lead in a sci-fi TV show. At the time, he was best known as a member of the Royal Shakespeare Company. He faced a lot of skepticism about whether he was right for the role, including from Star Trek's creator, Gene Roddenberry, but Stewart went on to embody one of Star Trek's most beloved characters. Stewart has continued to work on many other projects, including multiple Shakespeare productions, his one-man version of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, and several X-Men movies as Charles Xavier. During the pandemic, Stewart has been providing a little light on Instagram by reading sonnets to his followers. Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger spoke to Patrick Stewart. They started with a clip from Star Trek Picard. Years earlier, Picard had resigned his commission at Starfleet and retreated to his family vineyard in France to live out the rest of his years, embittered that the United Federation of Planets had lost its way. But a confused young woman named Daj appears at his home asking for help figuring out her identity. It turns out she's an android, and perhaps related to Picard's old friend Data, who sacrificed himself to save Jean-Luc. Daj is killed by unknown assailants who also injure Picard. Here he is, recuperating, angry at himself for failing her, and shoring himself up for one more adventure.
She deserved better from me. I owe it to her to find out who killed her and why.
You ask too much of yourself.
Oh, sitting here all these years, nursing my offended dignity, writing books of history people prefer to forget. I never asked anything of myself at all.
No, Admiral.
I haven't been living. I've been waiting to die.
And that's a scene from Star Trek Picard, starring my guest today, Patrick Stewart. Patrick Stewart, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Sam. I'm very happy to be talking to you.
I'm happy to talk to you, too. To prepare for this interview, I watched the new series, but I also went back and watched some of Star Trek The Next Generation. And one of the things that was, I guess, comforting about watching that show is that this vision of the future that's in Star Trek is, it's a fundamentally optimistic vision.
It's a
utopian, not dystopian vision. And sure, there are problems in this world, but the things that it points to is diplomacy and working towards peace and racial harmony, both on our world and across the galaxy. And that's been very reassuring for me to watch these days.
Yes. Well, I think that we have been fulfilling that in the series Picard. The whole issues of international problems, of refugees, of organizations, whether it's Starfleet or the Conservative Party in London, changing what they are, what they were, and what their priorities were. So we did reflect that. I mean, even so, it was very modestly done in Picard. But it gave me a sense that we were behaving responsibly. I think that Star Trek Picard is still fundamentally optimistic, although it has taken Jean-Luc a whole season to bring himself around to that belief. When we first meet him, he is a rather severely depressed, anxious, guilt-ridden, bored old man. Well, some of those elements vanished during the course of the first season, I'm happy to say. Although it was very interesting to have to perform them, to act them and make them real. And I am sure that whenever we get to start shooting season two, which we will shoot, that will continue in the same way.
I'd like to talk about how you first got the role of Jean-Luc Picard. First of all, did you have any reservations about taking the lead in a science fiction series? I mean, here you are at the time, this very well-regarded Shakespearean actor, and you're going to be in this sci-fi series wearing, you know, a tight-fitting unitard with lines full of techno-babble. Did you have any reluctance?
I'll tell you exactly what my reluctance was. First of all, I was, I came back, I think, three or four times to audition for this role. And the last time I came back, my agent said to me, well, this is it. It's between you and another actor. And by the way, I have never been able to find out who the other actor was. Maybe he actually didn't exist. Maybe my agent made that up.
Throwing a little competition at you.
Yes, exactly, which does no harm. But I was unprepared for what being cast in an American TV series meant, because I'd never done that before. I'd done, miniseries in the UK and so forth. But the day after I'd had the offer, my agent and I went to lunch, and he had the deal in front of him. He had the contract, and he began to go through it. And then he came to a point where he said, and of course, as usual, this is a six-year commitment. And I said, what? And he said, well, what did you think it was? And I said, well, I thought it was, you know, a dozen episodes. It was terrifying to me, because what it meant was that I was going to have to shut down my career, which actually, and I don't know whether there is any connection here, but actually had started to take off in a way that I was very pleased with. I'd been playing leading Shakespearean roles for a number of years, and now I was getting leading roles on television, and I was being offered transfers into the West End and transfers to Broadway. And the idea that I would have to shut that down for 6 years was horrifying. But that was when my agent was the very first person, and many others followed him, to say to me, look, don't worry about 6 years. That's in all these contracts. I've got to tell you, this show will be lucky to make it through the first season. You cannot revive an iconic series like those three seasons of the original Star Trek. You just can't. So you're not going to be here for 6 years. Forget about that. So I happily and delightedly signed a contract which committed me to 6 years, and we ended up doing seven.
Yeah, and many more years after that too, if you include the movies. Well, this might be a stupid question, but I'm going to ask it. Jean-Luc Picard is French, so why doesn't he have a French accent? I mean, there in Star Trek, you have a Russian accents, you have Scottish accents, Irish accents. Why does Jean-Luc Picard have a British accent?
Somewhere in the Paramount archives, there ought to be a videotape of me speaking Picard's lines with a French accent. They did actually want me to do that.
So was it rejected?
Oh, yes. I mean, I don't know that my French accent... I mean, obviously, if they'd wanted it, I would have worked on it and made it as impeccable a French accent as I could. But I think I know what I did. You know, the famous introduction, Space, the Final Frontier. I did that. You know, Space, the Final Frontier. These are the voyage of the Starship Enterprise. Well, that's how I did it. And it never came up again. Well, what did come up was, you know, the world, our Earth is now assembled under the Federation of Planets and Starfleet. There's no reason why he shouldn't be a Frenchman who is a brilliant French speaker, but also speaks English brilliantly with an English accent. So they agreed to that, but they also... We identified certain technical terms that would be given American pronunciations, and I was very, very happy to do that. I do remember quite a long conversation about how we should pronounce the name of the character played by Brent Spiner. Should it be Data or Data? And I was the one that campaigned for Data, and I'm very happy to say it was what won the argument.
I wanted to talk a little bit about your early years. You were born and raised in Yorkshire. And for the first 5 years of your life, you didn't know your father. He was serving in the war in a parachute regiment. And he was actually also one of the last men rescued at Dunkirk. We'll talk about this. It sounds like he suffered from what was not known then as PTSD, but certainly it sounds like he had that. But I was wondering... Did it scare you when he returned from home? I mean, here was this person that you didn't know who is now living in your house.
Yes, it did. I was very intimidated. My mother was a loving, charming, sweet, adorable person. And he was an interesting and exciting and colorful person. And of course, he'd had this extraordinary career, which had left him as a superstar in the non-commissioned officer sense. But also there were other aspects to it, which I only discovered the details of to my profound regret a few years ago. And I've talked to an authority on PTSD, told him about my father's behavior and his weekend alcoholism and his mood swings and the violence towards my mother, all of this I've talked about in the past. And he said, these are classic symptoms. There is no doubt your father was severely affected and needed medical help, which, of course, he never got. And it made me sad, because I've given my father a bad press over the years, that I couldn't speak to him now and ask him about these feelings and what it was and what he'd experienced. I will never know.
Your brothers are older than you. And in fact, one of them, I think, was also serving during the war. Did they have a different perspective on your father since they had known him before he had gone to the war?
Yes, very much so. My oldest brother, who was 17 years older than me and was indeed in the Royal Air Force, he disliked our father intensely. He had experienced him before Dad went to war in 1939. And I think that had been a bad time for him. So their, you know, shell shock or PTSD couldn't be blamed for that. And my eldest brother never, ever lived at home again. He lived with my mother's sister just across the road. But he and my father had a very, very difficult relationship, if there was enough there to call it a relationship. My other brother, Trevor, who is 5 years older than me, and I'm delighted to say is still very much with us, he and I had very similar experiences. But he was a calmer and quieter and more patient teenager than I proved to be. And so I think he was able to tolerate this difficult situation better than I could. I really had problems with it. It was not a great time. But as luck would have it, I fell under the influence of some wonderful people, most particularly my teachers. And then when I was 11 years old, a man called Cecil Dorman, who was my English teacher and first person to put a copy of Shakespeare into my hand and insist that I read it aloud. And interestingly enough, it was the trial scene from The Merchant of Venice, and he had me playing Shylock.
Yeah, and did you connect to that right away? Did you feel an affinity to Shakespeare and to even acting at that point?
I didn't know what the hell I was saying. I couldn't even properly read the words. I was not at an academic school, not remotely. In those days, they were called secondary modern schools. And yet, even though I couldn't understand the words or really what was going on, there was something about the sound of those words when I spoke them, the feeling of them in my mouth, that even then, I think intuitively, a rhythmic aspect to it as well touched me. And I was hooked for life. And here's the greatest thing. I called to wish my English teacher happy 95th birthday just a few weeks ago. We still talk on the phone every few months. He's a dear, dear, precious friend. That he's still in my life is a miracle.
When did you start feeling a connection to acting itself? I mean, it sounded like he was pretty young.
It was about the time that Cess Dorman put the copy of Merchant of Venice into my hand. He cast me in a play with adults. A lot of the staff of the school I went to, thanks to the enthusiasm of the headmaster, loved amateur acting. And most of the company, not all of them, but most of them were teachers in my school. And we did a play called The Happiest Days of Your Life, which was about two schools merging. It's a brilliant comedy. It was made into a film. And there was a character called Hopcroft Minor, who was a 12-year-old public school boy, and they cast me as that. There was also a young girl in it too. But first of all, I loved working with adults, especially the adults who were my teachers. And the most important thing that happened to me was that the first time I walked onto that stage to play my role, I felt safer. And I mean literally, physically, emotionally safer than I had ever felt in my life. And I think it must have been that that drew me back to acting. And then I joined other amateur groups. At that time, there was no consideration of becoming a professional. I just loved the experience of being someone else, not being Patrick Stewart, and exploring what my life might be like if I were someone else.
Patrick Stewart, thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed speaking with you. I've been really enjoying seeing you on television, and I'm looking forward to season two. And it's just been a real delight to speak with you. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I've enjoyed it, Sam, very much indeed.
Patrick Stewart spoke with our producer, Sam Brigger. You can watch the first season of Star Trek Picard on CBS All Access. It's been renewed for a second season.